You're good.
Cool. Okay, well, good afternoon. Just a quick heads up, I'm on a slightly earlier flight back, so it won't be the longest press conference today, but I do want to briefly talk about the budget. So the aim of Budget 2013 has been to continue building the competitiveness of our economy, help families, and at the same time maintain our fiscal discipline and ensure that government debt is under control. Our fifth budget is about building on the momentum of the previous four budgets across a wide range of government programs, and after two zero budgets we were able to devote $900 million to new operating spending initiatives. The budget continues to support our four main priorities this term, which are to responsibly manage our finances, to build a more productive and competitive economy, to deliver better public services, and support the rebuilding of Christchurch. In the budget, we saw announcements on housing, on both the social housing and affordable fronts, some measures to support vulnerable families, more on assisting growth and jobs, for example, through our internationally focused growth package and extra R&D assistance, and more spending in health, education, and supporting more people on welfare and into jobs, as well as the Christchurch rebuild. We've been able to do this against the backdrop of a continued fiscal discipline. Our responsible management of the government has allowed us to help vulnerable families. It's not really meant to be today.
Very sad sound, unfortunately.
We could all just go and have a drink. Fairly quiet news day, but anyway. Okay, when we came into office, we were facing a deep hole with the global financial crisis. We inherited a set of government books that had debt soaring to more than 60% of GDP by 2020, and no prospect of government budget surpluses again. On top of that, we're facing the worst global financial crisis since the Great Depression, and then the last term, the most costly natural disaster in New Zealand's history. So by any measure, it's been a remarkable turnaround to get from where we were then to where we are now, and all in all, we believe our fifth budget has been well received and continues to be seen in the same vein as our previous budgets. Just in terms of meat shipments to China, following on from the comments made by Primary Industries Minister Nathan Guy in the last hour or so, I don't have much field there, but I am advised my office has just received an update in the last 15 minutes from our ambassador, where he received an update from the Chinese government paying a visit to them. The ambassador confirms it is a technical issue that's holding up the shipments. The Chinese were waiting for some updated information from NPI, which I understand has now been provided. The Chinese are working through the information quickly and constructively, and we're hopeful the issue will be resolved this week. Just in terms of activities, it's a recess week, so I'll be in the Wairarapa electorate tomorrow, Auckland in the Kaikoura electorate on Wednesday, Christchurch on Thursday, and then Auckland again on Friday. And this weekend with the National Party Regional Conference, the last of them in Auckland, I'll be speaking on Sunday. And that's really about it.
This meeting is going to be a paperwork issue. Yep. You're confident that officials did enough in advance to preempt this problem?
Well, I don't think we have all of the information at this stage about exactly why there's been a bit of a breakdown. It's a technical issue as we understand it, and the Chinese side have been asking for more information. They've now apparently got all that information. But look, at one level, there's been changes on both sides. We've been changing the name of the organisation that's issuing those certificates. On the Chinese side, they've also been changing their procedures, and that's actually quite a good long-term thing, because they are working on making sure that there's more robustness about their system, and therefore the issue of counterfeit meat that is claimed to have come from New Zealand but maybe wasn't from New Zealand, can be combated. So it's, look, in the long-term, probably a good thing for New Zealand, but there's been a short-term hiccup.
We have those things sorted out.
We don't have an exact date for that, but my understanding now from the meeting that the ambassador had is the Chinese side do have all of the information they now require. The chilled meat, I think, is processing. The frozen meat is being kept frozen, so that's really just a short-term delay. So I'm confident they'll get through as quickly as they can.
And satisfied with the meat from China.
These things are always, you know, have a habit of sometimes taking a little longer than we would hope. I think both sides have been working through the information. So in the end, look, we'll have to go away and have a bit of a look and analyse what went wrong and why it took a little longer. I will say that, you know, we export to 160 countries in the world, and so from time to time these issues do present themselves, not so much on a systemic, you know, basis of a whole kind of category. It tends to be more by container, but it's not the first time it's happened to New Zealand.
Given that it's been a while since the name change, though, I mean, we've been a period, I suppose, before the name change, you change logos or stationery and things, isn't that something you just kind of tip off and then time?
Yeah, and I think on the MPI side, they would probably say that they did advise the Chinese side of the change, you know, via email and various other ways, but whether that was sufficient and enough, you know, clearly there's been a problem, now we need to work our way through it, but the main issue is resolving that, really.
So was there some Chinese concern that it was...
Are we handling this with unnecessary gloves? Because if this was the Australians that had done it, we'd be up in arms.
No, I think we are doing everything we can to get the issue resolved as quickly as possible. I mean, the Chinese side want to buy our meat. I mean, one of the big things that they raised when we went on the Chinese trip most recently was that the Vice Minister and a number of other very senior politicians said to us their desire to buy more meat from China. So I don't think there's really any issues there. As I said, I think, you know, there was, it's not unusual for there to be the odd problem. It's just that this escalated to something a little bigger. And it was at that point I think they realised it was a real issue they had to contend with. I think initially they weren't quite so sure.
You mentioned the issue of counterfeiting. Was there a concern from the Chinese side that this was counterfeiting?
I don't think so, but I think they've changed their system. So it's changes on both sides, and it's the change in their system of making sure that, you know, everything fits their new system that's been part of the issue. As I say, that robustness over time will help New Zealand, but in the short term, it's also been one of the contributing factors, but we don't claim to have all the information.
The Meat Industry Association says that there's been tens of millions of dollars and hundreds of tons of meat held up. All of the beef and sheep meat has been held up, the frozen stuff, for the last 2 or 3 weeks. Is that your understanding?
No, I don't think I could confirm it's that volume or for that length of time. It certainly is all meat exports, although I'm not convinced it's for that period of time. And some meat has been processed, or the chilled meat has been processed, as I understand it.
But not frozen.
No, frozen meat, no.
Do you think this is an issue of protectionism?
No, I don't. I don't think this is an issue at all of that. I think the Chinese have got a significant appetite at the consumer end for New Zealand meat. But they do want to purchase that, and in fact they see New Zealand as a very good supplier. I think it genuinely is one of those situations where it's possible we've been talking past each other.
Does it concern you that as of 45 minutes ago, MPI didn't even know what was wrong with the documentation, that apparently the Chinese officials, for one reason or another, hadn't told them what the problem was?
It's quite a devolved system, so, you know, at every level you're dealing with different people, so that sometimes is not, again, unusual, that on the ground at the ports are being told, you know, one particular issue. The Chinese side has been requesting information and New Zealand has been presenting it. And for the most part, I think the view that MPI held, that it was a technical issue of documentation, has proven to be correct. That's what the ambassadors confirmed as of the very recent meeting got out of 15 minutes ago.
Do you think this will at all affect New Zealand's trade relationship with China?
No, not in the slightest. I mean, China's a big growth market for us. The potential for meat exports to China is exponential. And long term, I think the processes will actually help New Zealand, but it's been a small short term hiccup.
Are you happy that the Chinese officials have been acting in good faith, considering no talks happened over the weekend because it was a weekend and they've only obviously entered into discussion with our officials today about it?
Yeah, again, look, as I said, I don't want to get into the blame game, but I genuinely do not believe there's anything more sinister about this. I think it's just simply a matter where the parties have had some changes in their procedures. They've been a bit talking past each other, and now we'll get on and resolve it.
Given all the work that we've been doing with China, particularly yourself at that high level over the last few years, are you surprised it's taken so long to talk to work out something like this?
I think when MPI was first advised there was an issue, it was, you know, very early last week, Monday/Tuesday, I think the minister knew, and at that point it wasn't, you know, it was sort of seen as very technical and something that would be resolved quite quickly. I mean, in truth, that is getting resolved relatively quickly, and they are processing the more fragile, you know, perishable nature of some of those products, but these things sometimes do take time. As I say, it's not the first time I've heard it.
Do you have any indication of how much meat's involved?
I don't know. I mean, I take it it's everything that we've sent up there in very recent times, so that's obviously a reasonable amount, and there's a reasonable amount on the water because the demand for Chinese meat, for New Zealand meat sourced, you know, by Chinese consumers is quite high.
Given that the minister doesn't know that he didn't know, what was actually wrong, are you confident with the way he's handled this? Has he
been a crossing? Yes, but I think even the meat companies themselves can't advise us exactly how much is there. I mean, again, if you did enough time, did enough work, of course you could go back and backtrack all that, but I don't think that's been his big focus of attention.
Has this happened before, and if so, how often?
In other markets, yes, without doubt, there's been issues where containers are held up or shipments are held up or there's been problems. As say, we export to 160 countries. So if you ask our ambassadors and high commissioners around the world, I think they'll tell you from time to time, yes, they've dealt with these issues. I can't tell you authoritatively about the Chinese situation when it's happened before. I just really don't know, but I suspect over the years, yes.
Why is it affecting only meat? Why not milk? Why not animal hides or other animal products?
Yeah, so that's to do with the change on the Chinese side. So as I say, our change is going from NAC or NZ Food Safety going to MPI, but on their side, it's the changes in the procedures of the way that they're dealing with meat.
Just for family here, as the bill that passed with the budget legislation over the weekend, there's been some concern about a clause that's been claimed to be unconstitutional, not allowing any further court action over that.
We certainly believe it's legal and constitutionally correct. I mean, I think what it does demonstrate is this is a really challenging issue about where you draw the line between family responsibility and where the state should play a role. There's no doubt that the court case involving Atkinson changed fundamentally where the Crown saw its responsibilities in terms of parents looking after adult disabled adults. So there's no question that that changed that where that line was drawn. I think the government's been trying to work through what is both fair and sort of reasonable as a line. And as a general rule, I think New Zealanders would accept that parents have responsibilities to look after their children. The difficulty here and the reason why the court case was successful is that there probably, in general terms, isn't an expectation that a parent would look after, a child as they turn to an adult for the rest of their lives. That's not normally what happens. There's some support, but not necessarily the level of support that's actually required for a severely disabled person. And so, it is probably appropriate that the Crown will pay those parents in what is a family situation to be the caregiver, and that's the move that we've made.
So
do
you expect court cases to be taken to take that further? I mean, why prevent them?
Well, I think there would be other court cases over time if the government hadn't taken the steps that they had. There's a bit more work, as I understand it, that the Ministry of Health is looking at a few other situations which could have characteristics which are similar. And so over time, I think there will be debate about these issues. But, I mean, as a general rule, we would say that in terms of support for New Zealanders, there's lots of areas where we give support. So even in the case of now, parents looking after adult disabled people or family members, the support in terms of paying for those that role as a caregiver is only one small part of the support mechanism that we provide. So we would say for children, where parents are looking after children that are disabled, actually we wouldn't pay a caregiver's role, we'd pay other costs, but there's an expectation of that most parents will look after their children if they're disabled or not.
Did you have any of these other cases that you're suggesting perhaps parents with disabled children paying as well?
Well, there's lots of other potential categories that you could potentially make a case for, but there's one other particular category that the Minister's looking at, and some more work will be done over the next 12 months on that.
Isn't it Gerald Shirtcliffe case involved with CTB? The Australian police have decided not to pursue charges against her. Yep. Are you satisfied that this is moving fast enough?
Look, I really don't have any details on that. I mean, I've seen the announcement by the Australian police, and I can't really add much more because I don't have all the details that they looked at.
Is this the top priority, though, the victims' families, to feel like they have some kind of closure?
Yeah, well, I understand completely how those families would feel and the enormous pain they've gone through and the need to feel that someone stands up and takes responsibility. But look, unfortunately, sometimes these things legally get very messy, and that appears to be the case.
Why did the government decide to not go ahead with the departure tax?
We looked closely at it. It's fair to say, as Minister of Tourism, I was attracted to the idea initially because I wanted to spend more money promoting New Zealand, and it wasn't immediately obvious to me that there would be resources available to fund the expansion of our marketing activities, particularly into new markets and the likes. In the end, we managed to find a way of financing that was arguably less disruptive, and so we abandoned the departure tax. But initially, at least, I thought it was worth doing some more work on it.
Is that off the table completely now? Because I was talking to Martin Sneddon before, and he said the tourism industry is going through their strategic review and
it's too early to say whether it would be a live issue after that. Is it a live issue for you, Steve?
I don't think it really is. I mean, we could have put it, you know, on the table, obviously. If we were going to do it, we would have done it this year. Don't really see it likely coming up for a wee while, because we're effectively financing over the next 4 years for the expansion. And the $158 million should be enough to do all the things they need to do, at least for the short to medium term. You can never say never in life, but I think that would be better.
Did you have any qualms about pushing through Parliament under urgency the carers legislation, because it extinguishes their legal right to take this matter to court again, and that's a very big step?
No, I think in terms of the specific area of parents looking after disabled now adults, we actually are fulfilling our legal obligations there. But in terms of other categories, then I think that was the right step to take.
Shouldn't it at least go on to a select committee for the public to have a say when you're encroaching on people's legal rights?
Well, we believe that will always be a matter of debate, and we have no doubt that, you know, parliamentarians and political parties and others may continue to want to debate that. But from the government's perspective, we think we're drawing the line in the fairest place we can. We're not saying it's perfect, but we think it's in the fairest place we can.
So you passed the law, so the debate's over, isn't it?
Yeah, in terms of our government, but that doesn't mean other people can't campaign on changes if they want to.
Concerns have been raised about its constitutionality with regards to the regulatory impact statement being blacked out, and with Chris Bellows raising concerns about Section 78 of the Bill of Rights Act. What's your response to that?
Well, my understanding is that it's constitutional.
By City Prime Minister, we've had the Court of Mentra report there released with when the deal was confirmed. When are you going to see the impact, the social costs, and why is that being held back now?
Don't know. You'd have to ask Stephen Joyce
that. Is there some reluctance to release that information?
I don't have any details, and he's raised it with me.
Prime Minister, how do you feel about MPs bringing babies into the House?
Oh, look, I think if there are rules that are set by the Speaker in that regard, and it's for the Speaker to determine what is appropriate and what's not. I think the rules do allow that, but I think Nanaia Mahuta actually left when the baby was crying. I mean, the only point I would make in relation to that is that the really important point to understand is it's the party whips that determine who gets leave and who doesn't. So there have been times in the National Party history when I've been involved in the National Party in Parliament where we've had MPs that have had very young children, had babies, Catherine Rich being the obvious example, and the whips prioritised leave where it was appropriate. So it was up to the Labor Party to determine who they gave leave to and who not. It's up to David Carter, the Speaker, to determine what rules are for the precinct.
I don't think babies are actually allowed in the House, but David Carter's been asked to maybe relax those rules. Would you support that?
Well, that's a matter for him. I mean, in the end, he makes those decisions. I mean, there's got to be a practicality about the way the House works. So my understanding was he made his Speaker's Lounge available. But as I say, you know, if there's without doubt, you know, a mother who is also an MP has to balance some real challenges from time to time. But I think it's actually the whips from the Labor Party's responsibility to acknowledge those challenges and prioritise the leave for that particular person.
Do you think Parliament's sitting hours are not friendly to families?
No, I think they've become increasingly friendlier. I mean, you think about it, we sit from a Tuesday to a Thursday. We sit about 32, 33 weeks a year, and we have recess aligned primarily with school holidays. So for the most part, it's a lot friendlier than it used to be when the sitting hours were longer and, you know, when the conditions were, you know, arguably harder. So it's pretty accessible getting in and out of Wellington now. For the most part, it's never going to be perfect, but I think it's better than it was.
You talked a couple of weeks ago at the Law and Act conference about attracting more quality women candidates. Yeah. Isn't incidents like this a little off-putting to women who have young families and children who might otherwise think about standing?
Well, we hope that they will come and stand for Parliament. I mean, it's practical that there'll be both women who during their parliamentary career have children, and there's that situation that's taking place at the moment with a member from the Greens, and it's happened again when I've been in Parliament with Catherine Rich. So we hope it doesn't put off women that want to become MPs, that they would consider that. There are challenges for them, you know, balancing all that. It's quite a demanding life being an MP. But if someone came to me and said that they were thinking about running for Parliament but in the course of their parliamentary career were likely to have children, I certainly wouldn't discourage them. I'd encourage them to do that. I think it's eminently doable. It's challenging, but it's doable.
How long would you leave feet in the freezer, deeming it eligible to throw it away?
how long would I leave meat in the freezer? You're really asking the wrong guy. I'm not Master Chief, I'm Prime Minister, but maybe 6 months or more, I think, so.
Depending on the meat. The Kira's situation for a moment. If they are prevented now from taking a case on the basis of feeling that discrimination against either by the government or the DHB, and the avenue of going to court isn't open to them, what avenue is open to them?
Well, it's the avenue of making their feelings publicly known. The government's position is quite clear. We've laid out our position. We've allocated $94 million for additional funding in this area. And as said earlier, it's a difficult situation of where to exactly draw that line. But you've got to remember, if you look in the history of Parliament, in previous situations, actually family members have not been paid to be caregivers. So any changes that may have been arguably advancements. But there are lots of permutations and combinations which could impose a very significant liability on future governments. And there's also a sort of general perception, I guess, of where state responsibilities start and stop and where family responsibilities start and stop. And that's always subjective. Different people will have a different view on where that line should be drawn.
Agreed. The constitutional point, though, is whether given that the 8th of last year was won on the grounds that the government's position infringed BORA, are you confident that your current position will not be subject to the same challenge, that it discriminates as well against rights under BORA?
Well, as confident as we can be, and in the end it's our responsibility as the government to pass the law that we believe reflects what is appropriate.
Today the Salvation Army put out a report that showed growing inequality between Pacific peoples and other New Zealanders. What's your response to that?
I didn't actually read the report, but I mean, I'm aware of it. And I mean, all I would say is that there's no question that the last 4 or 5 years have been very tough on lower income New Zealanders, notwithstanding the government doing everything it can to support them through the maintenance of programs like Working for Families and Entitlements and the likes. What's also true is we know from our general stats that Pacific people, there's a group of Pacific people who are lower income workers, so it's not surprising that they have been more badly affected as a group. But the government is working hard to basically make sure that the economy delivers jobs and opportunities, and that we are doing everything we can to make sure that young Pacific people are getting opportunities and access to education that can advance their careers. So we're working on a number of initiatives on that front.
There's a reduction in this year's budget for the Ministry of Pacific Island Affairs. Is that going to help if they're charged with lifting former outcomes for Pacific people?
I don't think that's correct, and I'm pretty sure the Minister's going to put out a statement clarifying that position later on this afternoon.
Just go back to the carers again. I mean, if you're confident that this is measures constitutional, why is the advice on this, or why is it all being blacked out from the
for impact statements so we can see for ourselves? Well, you'd ask
the Attorney General that. Prime Minister, in the budget, GCSB got $10 million less in output expenses this year. Why the less money?
Yeah, because their operational funding hasn't changed, their capital funding has changed, and we don't, for obvious reasons, go into which particular capital funding projects we fund, for clear reasons. But you wouldn't have to be a rocket scientist to work out that they've got a new building and that might have been paid for, in which case they don't need the money now.
Just going back to Sky City, the advice that Cabinet's received in terms of social costs, what does that say?
Again, you'd be best to go and direct. I don't
have
it with me.
You have said it though, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I don't have it with me, so you'd best to go and ask Stephen Joyce.
Can you give us an update on the talks around solid energy? Talking to its banks and Treasury the last update we had,
where's that at now? Well, it's fair to say the government is trying to work its way through a sensible outcome. So there are many options on the table. None of them are terribly palatable. But we're doing our best to try and resolve what is a quite broken company.
Do you have any problems with the banks having to take haircuts on the debt that they've...
No, it's my expectation that they would.
Is it still possible the company might fall over completely?
Well, every every option's theoretically on the table, but we're doing our best to try and work through what's a sensible sort of outcome. But, you know, it's in a very serious state. And, you know, all of the interested parties are working to see whether we can come up with an outcome that will deliver the best result. But, you know, it's fairly serious.
Is it more, the more you look at it, the more that you find that it's in a worse state than you see?
There are different elements of it. I mean, there's been some work done for the government by external consultants, and I think they would indicate some parts of the business are in better shape than others. So in totality, it's probably got no equity left and significant debts, but that doesn't mean there aren't some parts of it that are potentially genuine business. The question is, how the government can take the next step and what's required. And they say there's a number of options that we genuinely have not really managed to flesh out yet. We're working through that and need a bit more time.
Seems to have been a drawn out process, though. How much more time do you need?
Well, clearly a bit more, because we just simply don't have the answers to that yet. We know what the potential options are, but with it, we don't have clarity. And the Kuramentha report's only just been received, I think, and the ministers that are responsible for that have only just had an opportunity to have a look at it, but they're not in a position to advise me what they think that we should do next.
What's the time frame you're waiting to it?
I think within the next month or so we'd like to get to a point where we can at least give some clarity about next steps.
Are you concerned that banks, if they had to take a haircut, would treat other state-owned enterprise debt differently and be less...
No, I don't think they've ever believed that there was an implied government guarantee there. I think they've always been conscious of the risks, and you know, what the next steps are will be interesting for everybody, but that's it.
Well, has Mark Ford been talking a bit too cheerfully about this? Because a couple of weeks ago he said he personally thought it was a real go at the turnaround plan that they've come up with.
Well, I haven't seen his turnaround plan, so if it is, that'll be great, but it's not the advice I've had just yet.
Are you able to tell us which bits are savable or
not? I haven't read the report. I've just had an oral briefing on it and I only got it very, very briefly.
So your advice is that there's no chance of a turnaround plan?
No, not at all. I said there's every option on the table. There's a big range of options. But what happens next, I can't tell you. We don't know. We'll need more time to work our way through it.
But you don't sound very optimistic.
No, it's not that. There's a range of potential options.
Has Mark Ford painted you into a corner
bit? No. I mean, let's wait and see. He hadn't had, if he'd made that statement 2 weeks ago, he wouldn't have seen the report yet. And as I said, the report on the top line that I was orally advised says there's some good bits and there's some challenging bits, but there's a lot of debt and not a lot of equity, let's put it that way.
Thank you.